Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Brexit edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and financial collapse which is happening as a result of the extremely bad, terrible, no good, horrible vote that happened this week in the United Kingdom. Now, you probably don't need me to tell you what happened, but we are going to talk about it anyway. The short version is that there was an in-out vote. We had to decide, was Jordan Weisman going to be on Slate Money this week or not? And there was a vote. It was taken by Jordan Weisman
and his editor,
and who blamed immigrants and or his editor and said, "No, I have to be writing takes. I have no time to be faffing around on Slate Money." So what this means is that as of right now, we have no Jordan Weisman.
It's sad.
We do have Cathy O'Neill.
Yes, we do. That's amazing.
Which is welcome. And thankfully, it's not just me and Cathy. We also have Mr. Leo Carey. Hello, Leo.
Hello.
You do amazing things at The New Yorker.
I do adequate things at The New Yorker. I think, I'm just doing my best as an immigrant in this country.
But you are, as we can tell from your accent, you're English.
English.
And is it true we had Jim Surowiecki on a few weeks ago? Are you his editor?
I do edit him. I edit Jim.
So what that means is that, like, now, oh, Slate Money listeners, you get to find out who is smarter, the writer or the editor?
I don't quite like the answer of that. I think it might go the wrong way.
We will find out. So obviously this entire episode is going to be devoted to Brexit because we have far too much to talk about to fit into one or even
it's
just
not even
two.
Clear that it will fit into one episode.
Yeah, we might just have to spill over into next week as well.
Felix, tell me the truth. How much sleep did you get the night of the vote?
So so the truth is that we record this show on Friday mornings. I woke up at 7. Well, I basically didn't get any sleep last night.
Because I noticed you tweeting at 3 in the morning.
I put up my post. I put a post up on Fusion, which seems to have been getting a bunch of traction about Brexit and saying that England just fucked it all up for all of us. And that post went up at about 3:30 in the morning. And then I was so jazzed from all of that, you know, looking at screens and writing and tweeting and everything, that I couldn't get to sleep. And then right. I woke up in the middle of the night. Yeah. So this is a very jazzed Felix.
Wow.
And
okay.
sleepless. So if I'm making little sense, it's partly because I haven't had any sleep, and it's partly because I am just so sad. I was crying a lot.
A lot of people
night.
Have been crying.
It was a horrible, horrible thing to sit in this pub, to walk into a pub, the Churchill on 28th and Park, looking at the pound around 150, which was a 6-month high, and looking at all of the exit polls, which showed a significant majority for Remain, and looking at Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson, both who are the leaders effectively of the Leave campaign, both coming out and saying, it looks like we've lost. And I feel like that's what England wanted to do, that the people who voted for Leave, what they wanted to do was just to protest ineffectually, because English people love ineffectual
exact
protest.
Yes.
And then wake up in the morning and say, oh, the bloody Europeans, they're still in charge, and be able to still moan.
Yes. Tim Montgomery, I think, tweeted, you know, we've got so close, I almost could just like leave it here, and I think we've made our point. But then, you know, you've done more than you've made your point. You've seized events, and now you have to deal with them. There was a interviewee on the a Leave voter on the BBC today saying, you know, I voted out, and now I'm really scared. I mean, I always feel like my vote doesn't count, and you know, now it does. You know, it does count. And referendums, it's as if with parliamentary democracy, everyone's just driving a little car, and a referendum, you have this sort of power steering, like you've just screwed it up for everyone. And you know, it's a combination of people feeling powerless, and then suddenly being given colossal power.
Being given colossal power by the single most idiotic decision that I can remember any politician making in like my life. David Cameron learned his lesson after he called the Scottish referendum, which was way closer than it should have been. And he's escaped by the skin of his teeth that Scotland managed to remain a part of the UK. And what he learned in Scotland was you never call a fucking referendum because you cannot predict the results. They're inherently unpredictable things. And yet somehow, because he's a moron and because he wanted some stupid little tactical advantage in the 2015 general election, which is not an important election at all, he decided to promise a referendum if he won. I mean, what was he thinking?
It just seems that there's been a sort of groundswell within the Tory party asking for that for a while. And so it's finally, you've got to throw these people a bone if you want to keep control of your party. And it's one of these things where you make a decision that you probably think is bad at the time, but it seems like the least worst one. And then you know, he's always been lucky. Scotland went the right way. You know, he was looking like he might lose the last election or be with an even, you know, with in an even more precarious coalition. And you know, I think he's always been a gambler. He's always been lucky. And now he's not lucky.
Can he show his face in public anywhere?
I really doubt it.
I'm going to jump in here, and I know I'm completely outnumbered. But doesn't it strikes me as like somewhat as condescending to say, oh, there was a majority vote and they were all hoping not to win. I mean, obviously some of those people wanted to leave the European Union. So, I mean, can we talk about what happened?
You know, I think there is a big issue of an electorate feeling patronized by a huge swathe of the commentariat. And I actually thought, you know, in the last week or so, the Brexiters have been building, you know, there's been this steady drumbeat of as I would see it, fanning a sense of grievance among the electorate, or you know, if you're a Brexiter, you'd be just alerting to people to, you know, their options. But that's been going on for years, with extreme commitment on the UKIP, Brexit, and Eurosceptic Tory
side. Importantly, the British press. This was started by the Daily Telegraph, which discovered decades ago that it could sell newspapers by making up stories about how Brussels wanted to regulate the curvature of your bananas.
Yeah, but I think we're letting ourselves off too lightly if we want to just be like, oh, it's the stories that Boris Johnson was writing in the late 90s. Oh, look at all those Daily Mail front pages, those Daily Express pages that have got scaremongering immigrant things. I think you can't say that the people who voted out didn't have an authentic desire to be out.
And I think the authentic desire was deeply linked to fear of immigration, surely.
Sure. And the people trying to persuade them to remain never successfully addressed that. I guess the polls started looking really bad about 3 weeks ago. And at that point, you felt like Remain sort of, having been relatively passive, kicked into a higher gear. But what their higher gear was just having every famous rich person say, I'm in Remain, you know, Richard Branson,
well,
Dave Beckham.
The problem was you can't use the truth. This is exactly the same as trying to run against Donald Trump, is that, like, you can't, you know, the Leave campaign says there are 70 million Turks that are going to join the EU and then they're going to come into the UK. Now, this is completely ridiculous. Turkey isn't anywhere close to joining the EU, but it's a lie which is irrefutable because people want to believe it.
Yeah, I wonder how much they even need to believe that thing. They just wanted to vote and vote out. You know, what you had against that was a series of extremely, you know, sedulous explanation of exactly what. Now, Brexiters, listen to us. You know, we've got the figures here. Look, you see the sums, you see how it works. So you see it only makes sense to stay. And to tell an electorate that they're wrong, to think what they're thinking is a recipe for electoral disaster.
If you could go back 6 months and be in charge of the Remain campaign, what would you do?
I think you have to go back further. You have to make a much broader segment of English society feel an emotional investment in Europe, because ultimately, you know, people when they're going to vote, you know, they may have a particular issue. They may have some stats in mind. But, you know, here we are on Slate Money in a kind of the heart of the sort of technocratic kind of, you know, it's all about, you know, markets, or what do the betting markets say, or what does the street think? You know, actually people make very emotional decisions when they vote. And if you can't connect with them on that level, it's no use complaining, you know, and saying, well, you know, it was a appalling campaign they ran. They, you know, And you know, I think absolutely, you know, Farage's final anti-immigration post was a shameful thing, and you felt awful to see it and to be British. But there's no point in just sticking your hand up and saying ref, you know, that's a foul. There is, you know, this. You have to engage an electorate on the terms on which it wants to be engaged. And I think there's a massive failure to do that.
This is something which I've said on Slate Money many times in the past, and surely will many times in the future, is that when economics runs into politics, politics always wins.
Yes.
That what we had was, you know, the OECD and the Chancellor of the Exchequer and all of these, like, you know, as Michael Gove famously said, like, experts, saying, you're going to have a recession if you do this. And everyone was like, yeah, okay, whatever.
And also, you know, bringing up the markets. Like, the markets totally were surprised by this.
And I need to, before we talk a little bit about the political implications in the UK and the EU, we do need to mention the crazy that happened in the markets on Thursday night. That after hitting a 6 month high of $150 to the pound, the pound then managed to collapse in the space of just a couple of hours, basically, to about 132, something like that. This is unprecedented in you know, living memory. I saw someone on Twitter calling this a 16 sigma move, which Kathy is going to laugh at because she knows that means, you know, that's like, it doesn't happen in the course of the lifetime of like 100 universes. But
well, that's assuming a random walk. This was anything but a random walk. But, we all knew something was going to happen.
But so this, the market volatility has been crazy. The 10-year bond yield is now down to like the lowest it has ever been in the U.S. There's been this crazy flight to safety. The yen is super strong. This Japanese stock market is super weak.
Why is the Japanese market down like right now as of Friday morning, like almost 10%? I don't get that.
Partly because the yen, because there was this huge flight to safety in the yen, which has strengthened the yen, which has made Japan much less competitive.
Okay. Mm.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So now let's talk a little bit more about the politics.
Yeah.
Because we have Leo here who understands this stuff and is much more keeps in much closer touch with UK politics than I do.
Though actually I would like to just say, you know, I've lived here for almost 19 years, and I think part of the fallacy is to assume that you know your country. I think people who have not left England and stayed there during those 19 years are waking up and feeling the same thing. But, you know, England has got such a powerful identity and it's so cozy and it's got a sense of humor and, you know, these beautiful little, you know, beautiful countryside. And it always just seems like it's sort of eternally going to remain the same. And you can, as an expatriate, lose sight of the fact that it's a highly dynamic society. Even just to think of you know, how different London looks from when I left.
But that kind of dynamism is exactly why so many of us were reasonably complacent about the fact that it was going to go to remain in. That
I like reasonably complacent. That's a very, very interesting locution. because there is, you know, there is a complacency in reason. There's a complacency in being right. There's a complacency in being, we have the facts on our side. We'll just lay them out. And people will listen.
But also, when you see dynamism, when you see immigration, when you see change, when you see an economy being driven off of the input of people from all over the world, and London being this incredible global city, and of course, London voted overwhelmingly to remain.
Though the outskirts, I mean, Watford, you know, the Leave came much closer to the center of London. And, you know, that whole Thames Estuary region, which is a commuter belt.
So the question which I have for you is really like, when you're saying that we aren't really plugged into to the changes that are happening in England, are you saying that there was a change in the opposite direction? And there was a change to a much more sort of little England conservatism, which somehow we missed?
I do think there has been that change, but it's based on things that are so anecdotal that I would feel kind of embarrassed to say them into a microphone. You know, I think if you're, you know, obviously every day you go online and you see what the Guardian's saying and you see what the Telegraph is saying and you look at the Mail site. And so you sort of, you know, you look around, and you feel you've got a good spread of the opinion, but it's different from having, you know, a front page that lands on your doormat each day and tells you something. That's a steady drip.
And tells you that the immigrants are coming to destroy the country, basically. Yeah. I can't emphasize this enough. Like, for all the analysis, ultimately, this really did come down to a vote about immigration and a vote against immigration, even though, I hasten to add, there is absolutely no reason to believe that leaving the EU will reduce immigration.
Can I jump in here? I've been looking at the demographics of the vote, and I'm just going to echo what Leo said a little bit, that, you know, the people that voted to remain were educated, they were cosmopolitan, they were richer. They are, in fact, the people that we hear when we listen. Right?
Yeah.
They're louder mouthed than the people who voted that are disgruntled, they're poorer, they're older, and they're in the suburbs, essentially. So that's an important thing. It's a selection bias for what the information that leaks to our brains.
Even if
you were in London, that would be in effect, right? Even if you actually lived in the UK, it's not clear that you would hear those voices, just as we don't in the United States really understand exactly what's happening in the rural South.
But there are so many parallels here. The Republican Party barely exists anymore. And is it not the case, Leo, that the Tory Party is tearing itself apart in a similar way?
And, both parties, and, the splits and are everywhere.
And this is the real shocker to me. This is the thing where I was like rubbing my eyes and said, I can't believe it. There was no single return of the election which shocked me as much as seeing that a substantial large majority of Tory MPs voted for leave, despite the fact that the official Tory party position was to remain.
Well, yeah, and I'll jump in again because I'm not British, okay? I acknowledge that. But one of the things that I've talked to a bunch of people about the Brexit vote, and like the Greek friends I have are very conflicted, and it's not because of immigration for that. Well, it's partly because of immigration, but it's also partly because of the way they see the lack of democracy firsthand living in Greece.
But the Greeks, you know, essentially had that in-out vote and voted to stay in.
Yeah, yeah, they did. But I'm just saying they're conflicted about it.
And Yanis Varoufakis was like doing tours of the UK saying stay in.
I'm just saying there are more issues than immigration.
Yeah, and it's true. I actually think that, compared to Greece, which when that vote was taken was, you know, a basket case, you know, England is quite comfortable and it's forgotten what real crisis feels like. And I think it's about to find out. You take a leap in the dark. Yeah, people maybe feel that desperate or they don't have a voice or something. But I think people with a keener sense of what, say, 25% unemployment would look like, you know, people voting in that country think about these things considerably more seriously.
Yeah, in that sense, I think that they were just slightly disgruntled, not compared to Greece, but slightly disgruntled. And then they were told they were wrong. As you mentioned, that doesn't feel good. So it became a proxy for everything they felt frustrated by.
Precisely.
Right?
And Leave never really had to give any sense of what they were going. You know, there is no plan.
There is no plan. And to be honest, I mean, there's this thing called Article 50, which technically allows the country to leave the European Union. Obviously, no one has ever invoked it. It needs to be called by the government, which of the country which is leaving. David Cameron has said that he's not going to fucking do it, which means he's going to resign. He's going to be replaced by someone else. The person who replaces him is going to have to do it, or maybe there's going to be a general election. Like, I mean, I have to say, like, somewhere deep in my heart, I hold out some hope that Parliament is going to come to its senses and just refuse to invoke Article 50 and refuse to leave.
Yeah, it's hard to see how the politics of that works now. It could work gradually, because I think what the Brexit campaign was promising was essentially an impossibility. If they're given power, eventually people will become pissed off with them. But it's not clear that that can happen quick enough to prevent the Article 50 trigger being pulled, which creates a timeline of 2 years to exit. Perhaps the most interesting question for the next week or two is, what does the establishment do now? Because let's not kid ourselves, the people in charge of the Brexit campaign are also the establishment. I feel that, like, if you're Boris Johnson or Gove, you've got 2 days of euphoria and then you are shitting yourself because you not only did you drive the car off the cliff, you now have to remain in the car and try and get it somewhere and make people feel that they're better off than they were.
Leo,
with market
turmoil
all around you.
Do you think that Boris Johnson is going to be the next prime minister?
I don't think I've got a special insight. I think it does seem that everything he has done has been aimed at this, and I think it is highly likely. But I think also within the Tory party, I get the sense that people might try and rally around someone who seems like less of a show pony. Like maybe Theresa May will have more support within the party. You know, it's not like a US presidential campaign is essentially an entrepreneurial act. Like anyone can go for the nomination, whereas, you know, leadership battles in England happen within a party structure. So the guy who's on TV most often might not be actually be the guy who's in the strongest position.
No, and just to explain here, because most of our listeners have not grown up in a parliamentary democracy, the way the party leader is chosen in the UK is literally just in the Tory party anyway, is by a vote of the MPs in Parliament. The people have no say.
So interesting.
And it's just the Tory MPs get to choose their leader. So, yeah.
Which seems fair, I think, in a way.
The Labour Party, of course, has a very different system and managed to elect, you know, a crazy person as its leader, which didn't help in the campaign because the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, no one really believed that he was particularly pro Remain.
Yes, and I think that touches on a very interesting thing, which is that the sort of multidimensional splits that seem to be in every faction here. I read somewhere a statistic that, you know, 45% of Labour membership was for out, and, you know, obviously in the Northeast, it's those old sort of industrial heartlands that have been kind of treading water for 20, 30 years with the decline of industrialization that have switched from a kind of old left class-based mentality to, you know, moving towards a UKIP rightist mentality. And I don't think that vote will come back to Labour. I think that's structural.
This is the same weird thing that we see in the UK with people vacillating between Bernie and Trump, right?
What I was going to say is, so you've got that split. You've got, as it were, new Labourites who are urban and, you know, neoliberal and, you know, take their holidays abroad. And then you've got old Labour, which has felt like, you know, there's been nothing in it for me since Blair took over, since maybe the departure of Kinnock. And then in the Tory party, you have a similar split, which is between, you know, urban kind of, you know, markets good, you know, essentially economic conservatives, and then something that's far more sort of, you know, atavistic and chthonic, that's sort of related to sort of a sense of like England's sort of eternal specialness. And it split that way. And what I think's most interesting now is actually Brexit has a split too. Obviously, most of it is nativist. Most of it is anti-immigration and highly protectionist in the way that you see with Bernie's supporters and Trump's.
But Boris highly is the opposite.
Yes. And the theory that the very, very few economists who think things will get better are all, you know, complete free market fundamentalists. They're like, we're much better like negotiating contracts, you know, outside the EU. We'll sail our little skiff more nimbly rather than just sitting on that sort of EU tanker. We can like be like, hey, India, want to do a deal? China, want to do a deal? And like, you know, so that is the thinking there. And you just know, yes, you know that Boris and the guy who voted for his campaign in bumfuck, wherever it, bumfuckshire, you know that those two people have a completely different idea of what this thing is going to look like.
So,
and there will be great anger when the people who voted for this find that it does not achieve what they wanted.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Now I want to move on to this, the question of how does this look from the outside and what does this mean for the people who didn't vote for it, which means Europe, which means the US. But let me start first with a kind of more interesting one, which is Scotland. Scotland voted completely, 100%, every single county in Scotland voted to remain. Can you explain to me what's going on there? Why is Scotland so different than Northern England?
I don't know. I think that, again, it comes down to an emotional thing. You've got an identity that is Scottish and that is highly proud of being Scottish, even if it voted to remain in the UK at the referendum. It's highly – people have a sense of pride. It's not clear to me that in the North, which used to have a very firm sense of pride, that pride's kind of been kicked out of you if you're in the north of England. You know, your economic circumstances, you know, one side of the border might not be that different, but the way you feel perhaps about your identity, you cannot discount just the sort of resentment of London and the fact that...
And this is, I think, the key, is that the English get to resent Brussels. The Scots don't need to resent Brussels because they can just resent London. And no, I think this is
a degree of self-government. You know, the Northeast doesn't have its own regional parliament.
But let's move out one level here. What are the Germans thinking? What are the French thinking? What is the rest of Europe thinking this morning?
I think that what they have to be thinking is how do we proceed? Do we, in other words, play hardball with England and be like, take it or leave it, you know, you've made your bed, now lie in it? Or are they, will they try everything they can to keep it together? In other words, will they negotiate from a position of essentially punitive vindictiveness or suddenly scared flexibility.
But I think have to be punitive, don't they? Otherwise, well, every other country is going to vote.
Yeah,
to
it's
leave.
A moral hazard issue.
There is a moral hazard issue. But I mean, today, Juncker, Jean-Claude Juncker, was immediately, you know, there can be no negotiation. I'm sad, but it's done. But Donald Tusk, very, very different. Like, kind of, let me see what I can do here. Let me get back to you. And even if it doesn't, which probably won't happen sufficiently speedily to get England not to leave, I think, you know, that this vote had been taken yesterday in France, it would very likely have gone the same way.
I mean, I feel like Pandora's box has been opened now and it's very hard to close it. It's going to be very hard for the French government to refuse a referendum. It's going to be hard for the Spanish to refuse referendums for, like, both independence within Spain and from the EU. And that what we're going to see now is a series of votes to leave, because I don't think that even half of the current countries in the EU would vote to remain if they had a vote like this.
I've got less of a sense of it than you maybe on that. But I do think that, you know, it was occurring to me that, you know, the critiques of European institutions are completely well-founded. It is highly top-down. It isn't answerable. It's not very democratically answerable, partly, of course, because national governments wanted to keep that democratic relationship to their individual electorates. And if it were more democratic, it would have posed a more direct challenge to national government much earlier. But at this point, the EU is kind of like Microsoft Word, you know? There's a lot of – it's bulky. It doesn't do exactly what you want. If we were writing this application today, we wouldn't do it like this. But how can you unpick it and reform it within the current structure and on what looks like an absolutely emergency timeline?
Right, exactly. Like, it would have been almost impossible to reform the EU even if we had voted to remain because of all of the structural problems there. But once we voted for – leave. Now it's just unthinkable.
Yes, it was an impossible task in either sense, but now it's an impossible task while someone's holding a gun to your head.
Well, it's you know, I heard someone on the radio saying it's like Merkel has been kicking the can down the road and now the can has stopped. Mm-hmm. You know, like what could possibly happen at this point to prevent this cascade of people, of nations leaving? What could they even offer?
So I want to ask you, Kathy, I mean, just broadening this out one new level, is the view from the US. It has struck me, living here in America, that Americans really weren't paying a lot of attention to this up until the vote itself.
I totally agree. I think most Americans think that, you know, don't really know the difference between the Eurozone and the European Union, and knew that there was
probably
still
quite
a pound.
Probably a lot of Europeans don't either. Well,
they knew there was still a pound and that it wasn't on the Euro system. And then they kind of, oh, there's something else, you know. So it wasn't big on the list. And you know, I know that people say it's going to be bad for the U.S., but at the same time, look at the markets. They're not down that much for the U.S., and people are going to they're going to flee to
the
American
stock
things.
The market isn't down that much, but the scary thing is that the bond market is up that much. The scary thing is that we're seeing right now exactly what we saw in 2008, 2009, which is this huge flight to quality trade.
Yes.
And, you know, we have the 10-year bond yield at unprecedentedly low levels. We have Janet Yellen and the Fed basically saying we were all set to raise rates, but now all bets are off, because there's a good chance that, put it this way, if the UK enters a significant recession, as it probably will, that and if Europe is entering 2 years or more of extreme uncertainty and economic uncertainty, And Europe is not exactly an economic powerhouse right now in terms of economic growth. That could turn negative. All of Europe could go into recession. If all of Europe goes into recession, that then impacts the U.S. It's bad for the U.S. economy. And suddenly the Fed is like, yeah, I don't think we're raising rates. I mean, it's now zero rates as far as the eye can see everywhere in the world.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. It's not good, obviously. One of the things I'm interested in looking at is the extent to which, like, London is the financial center of Europe in a certain way, right? There's so much going on in finance in London. And to the extent that the United States has a huge financial industry, which it does, it connects to Europe basically through London. Like, what's going to happen with that?
I saw a headline.
Yes.
Like, already I saw Morgan Stanley.
2,000 people to Dublin or Frankfurt. Yes, exactly. And it's, you know, this has been a threat for a long time. Like, you know, it's every election. Like, you know, if someone, you know, too hostile to the city of London gets in, you know, people will just leave, you know, because, of course, you know, capital is global. It's just very, very mobile. But, you know, the people who work might, you know, have a house and their kids in school, and you wonder how mobile these people are. And we're about to find out.
We are. I mean, financial capitals. It is quite common for them to be in small little island, you know, Singapore's and Hong Kong's and Dubai's and stuff like that. But certainly, I mean, it's inarguable that the primacy of London as a global financial center is absolutely a function of the fact that the UK is a central member of the EU. And if that's no longer the case, then yeah, a lot of those jobs are going to move to Frankfurt. But that's not even the main problem. I mean, if a bunch of bankers move from London to Frankfurt, who the fuck cares?
Yeah, I think many people who voted, that's a feature rather than a bug.
Exactly. Like, you know, it means, I mean, if house prices in London come down, that's good.
It depends.
You know, I mean, like, in London, you have to be terrified that house prices will fall and really hope that they fall simultaneously, because clearly it's not sustainable. But, you know, the basic English middle class is highly invested in housing. And apart from, I suppose, a generation that hasn't managed to get on the housing ladder, if you let house prices fall in England, you're dead politically.
Well, okay, but it could fall locally. It could fall. The housing prices could get more reasonable.
Yeah, but there's a lot of southern England. I mean, that's not just locally. If London falls and the London sort of, you know, surroundings fall, which is where the biggest bubble has been, then I fear to think, you know, what the solvency of the UK banks would look like.
All those, you know, you know, York was becoming a commuter town to London. The train service is pretty good, you know. Oxford, where I'm from, if you take incomes to property, is the most unaffordable city in England because it's essentially becoming a dormitory for London. There'll be a huge kind of letting of this air out of the balloon if London prices start to fall. I think, you know, other places around it will fall faster.
Every single property in the UK has already fallen in value by 15%. You know, if you're just looking in dollar terms.
If you're looking in currency terms, yes. And people are in fact talking about a mini bubble as opportunistic foreign money comes in, you know, in the next weeks while sterling is depressed, that actually you could see in the upper end of the property market, you know. I'm an oligarch, and you know, I was kind of like going either way on this sort of penthouse, and like, you know, actually it's come down in price.
It's true. If you're a Russian buyer, man, that thing just got 15% cheaper.
I mean, I looked at
this. This is my favorite thing, by the way, of the market crazy, was that the pound fell by about 7 or 8% against the Zimbabwean dollar.
I looked at the pound graph and it really, I mean, yes, it's lower than it's been for a long time, but it's not that much lower than it was right after the 2008 crisis. It's not like plummeting beyond memory or anything.
It's at a 30-year low.
Yeah. But it's been a few times.
It went from a 6-month high to a 30-year low.
No, it was dramatic. No question.
In the space of hours. Like, that's just crazy pants. And we don't know where it's going to end.
We don't know where it's going to end. Like, it might be different by tomorrow.
It could easily, and in fact, I would go so far as to say probably will turn out to be a Lehman Brothers situation. That on September the 15th, you know, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, the markets went down in a kind of like stomach-churning way, and everyone said, wow, that was nasty. And then over the subsequent 6 months, it got so much worse.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, in my piece after the Brexit, I wrote that things are going to get worse before they get worse.
Nice.
Which I hope is false. I hope that somehow – but right now I have to say, and I think Leo agrees with me, that it's really hard to see any silver lining to this cloud. There's very little upside. In fact, there's no upside to this. Not for England, not for the UK, not for Europe, not for the globe, for no one. No one is winning from this. Not even Boris Johnson is winning from – not even Nigel fucking Farage is winning from this. Everyone is losing.
I think Farage is winning, but up to there, I'm with you.
You know what? I'm going to – I just want to do this. I've never done this before, but I'm going to read a letter to the editor of the FT, which has been tweeted a bunch. And I just – it was such a great note on the FT website. A quick note on the first three tragedies, and this is actually the point that, like, there are so many tragedies here, and this guy just managed to come up with three off the top of his head. First, it was the working classes who voted for us to leave because they were economically disregarded, and it is they who will suffer the most in the short term from the dearth of jobs and investment. They have merely swapped one distant and unreachable elite for another one. Secondly, the younger generation has lost the right to live and work in 27 other countries. We will never know the full extent of the lost opportunities, friendships, marriages, and experiences we will be denied. Freedom of movement was taken away by our parents, uncles, and grandparents in a parting blow to a generation that was already drowning in the debts of our predecessors. Thirdly, and perhaps most significantly, we now live in a post-factual democracy. When the facts met the myths, they were as useless as bullets bouncing off the bodies of aliens in an H.G. Wells novel. When Michael Gove said the British people are sick of experts, he was right. But can anybody tell me the last time a prevailing culture of anti-intellectualism has led to anything other than bigotry? That is the England that we woke up to this morning, a little confined England where you can't just move to France if you fancy, like, you know, I mean, oh, it's just the worst.
I think anyway. Not enough people were experiencing the upside of the optionality of moving to France, and that's why they voted as they did. And I think that the sense of an us and them sense, which I, you know, as it were, naturally my feed is all people like being, who are these fuckers who fucked it up? But, you know, that rather justifies the opinion of those fuckers that these stuck up elites pay them no mind, pay them no respect. There's no neutral position in this.
It's true. Like I have talked to a bunch of people about Brexit, and the one thing which I've never found is someone go, eh, I don't really have an opinion on Brexit.
I talked to an economist who was like, you know, he was Greek, which may or may not be significant.
He was like,
I think it will come out pretty much a wash. I think they'll, you know, that they'll negotiate the contracts again, and you know, what makes sense as a sort of level, they'll be roughly the same. You know, it'll be a lot of work, but I don't think it will fundamentally change anything. Which is like a kind of, you know,
that's the best case scenario right now.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So, Kathy.
Yes.
Number. Do you have one?
I do. Having nothing to do with Brexit. A little break for people. $10 million, which was an incredibly pathetic and paltry fine that the SEC levied against Merrill Lynch for lying to its retail investors about a structured product where basically they divulged that that it was at least 6% of any kind of profits over a 5-year period would be pocketed by them. But then they failed to mention that actually also there was another charge of 1.5% every quarter. So $10 million. I mean, this is the way the SEC wins, is that they fine Merrill Lynch like less than is actually noticeable by Merrill Lynch for doing something that probably screwed just a whole ton of people.
I mean, $10 million is the bonus that most Merrill Lynch currency traders just made in one day.
For selling this product to one person or something.
My number, and I could have so many, but the one which jumped out at me during that long, dark night of the Brexit was the Google Trends tweet saying that there was a 500%, there's my number, 500% spike in searches for buy gold over the course of 4 hours.
Or how do I like move to Ireland?
This is definitely a kind of, you know, stock up on canned goods kind of, you know, scenario that we're living in here. You know, this is extreme. But yes. Leo.
My number is £350 million.
The worst number.
The worst number and a false number. But this is a very important number in the Leave campaign, because that's what the UK's weekly fee to the EU has been. And you know, in a way that sort of makes perfect sense. You know, the Leavers were like, you know, £350 million a week, that might come in handy. What we just imagine what we could do with that.
We and they could had, give it to the National Health the, Service. The that was the thing.
To which we will pay, lip service to caring about. There was a big red poster with an electrocardiogram sort of blip on it saying, let's give our NHS the £350 million the EU takes every week. Vote Leave, take control. Now, the number has always been false because it's sure it's what's paid to the EU each week, but it doesn't take account of what comes back from the EU, which is an £85 million a week rebate that was negotiated by Margaret Thatcher in 1985, and EU subsidies to British farmers, to the poor regions that have voted Leave, like in the Welsh Valleys, and to British business. Once you take that into account, you've got only a net payment of £136 million. So the head of the Leave campaign, who ironically is originally German, said, you know, this will be for the NHS, but it's a non-existent amount of money. And today, before 7 o'clock, before probably half the voters for Leave had woken up, Nigel Farage was on TV saying that, well, obviously, no, there isn't 350 million.
Oh.
No, there isn't. You know, I can't guarantee. That number, he said, was a mistake. And she said, how? And
then, oh, I'm sorry.
On Sky. It was a mistake.
Holy
no, that's a mistaken
shit.
Number.
And, amazing.
And so I just think this is the number to end all numbers, because it shows, as your FT comment guy says, the post-fact nature of politics, the bad faith in which that number was adduced, and even I think with which it was received, because I think a lot of levers are like, you know, it was debunked again and again and again and again through the campaign, and I think many levers probably got the message. Okay, well, that number's not right. Sure, but I think we'll get something. It was probably a lot of people's kind of groggy thinking as they voted. So it's a number that makes you realize the limits of numbers in this whole sphere of like human activity.
It's not about facts.
No. So I encourage all you Slate Money listeners to go out there and drink a lot.
I brought some scotch just to celebrate.
It is true. Kathy brought some scotch in, which
and,
I think
and
I
what
might
I
be helping myself
to. Is try to understand the people that you fear, because there's an election coming here, and you don't want to have a strange, unmanageable, populist result that's anti-elite. And I know we don't talk about domestic politics here, but that's
but yes, that's, it's absolutely
the,
true.
The T word
the
looks scarier.
The scary like red-faced blonde man, like, you know,
touching might, down might, in Scotland just in time for the
might be the next prime
yesterday.
Minister of the UK, or might be the next president of the US. Either one, I'm not sure which one is scarier.
It's a good year for blondes.
So all I can do is say thank you to Emily Rubin and to Audrey Quinn, who produced this episode, to Steve Lichtai and Annie Bowers, the executive producers of Slate Money, to the entire Panoply universe at itunes.com/panoply. And I feel, honestly, that maybe if we're looking for any silver linings here, that it is this, that now it is going to become even easier for Panoply to snaffle up all of those great BBC radio producers to come over here and work in New York and earn some dollars and create awesome podcasts, because they have no future in that benighted isle. Most of all, of course, thank you to Leo Carey of The New Yorker, who not only was much more intelligent than either Jim Sierowiecki or Jordan Weissman, but also managed to use the word chthonic, which really ought to be used in
every single
podcast.
I'm seriously looking that up.
So well done, Mr. Chthonic, Leo Carey.
You can't get by in England without that concept.
It's true. It's true. I managed to use the word gormless
in another key English concept, which is
a great word to use. But we will try and use more such words on future episodes when we talk to you next week and beyond on Slate. Oh, wait. I have to mention one last thing. Keep those emails coming. SlateMoney@slate.com. Kathy is rolling her eyes. She's like, I'm getting too many emails.
I love the emails. I just, as a data person, I want there to be some kind of structure, format.
If there's anyone who's listening to this who wants to volunteer to crunch all of the data from the numbers of the emails you've been sending in of your favorite podcasts, we really appreciate those emails, but we need someone to
be able
to...
We
need an intern to basically read through all of those emails and quantify which podcasts are your favorite. Anyway, come back next week. We will talk to you with more Slate Money.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.